begin this morning by stating a life principle, a very obvious life principle to many of us. Many of us have learned by experience this principle, and some of us have learned it by personal painful experience. Here it is. Sometimes you can't understand what you're looking at without an explanation. Sometimes you can't understand what you're looking at without an explanation. It's not always a painful thing. It's not always a costly thing. It can actually sometimes be sort of a funny thing. Like when the city guy had the opportunity to watch a farmer helping a calf to be born. He stood there watching as the cow gave birth to the calf, and the farmer was helping the calf make his entrance into the world. And at the end of the process, the city guy had his eyes bugging out of his head, and the farmer said, "Do you have a question, sir?" And the city guy said, "Yeah. How fast was the little one going when he ran into the big one?" Sometimes you can't understand what you're looking at without an explanation. And sometimes to lack the understanding because you lack the explanation is a painful thing or a costly thing. That's why we have house inspectors who come on the scene before we actually buy the house. And similarly, sometimes you can't understand what you're looking at without an explanation in regard to accepting a job offer or accepting a marriage proposal. Sometimes the explanation is absolutely necessary. Now, the event that we're celebrating today is exactly that sort of event. Palm Sunday is the celebration of Christ's triumphant entry into Jerusalem. And if you were a person watching all of that go on, as we've been picturing it ourselves this morning, you would be very much in need of an explanation because it would be so easy to misunderstand that very happy, triumphant entrance. Palm Sunday must never be separated from what was going to happen 5 days later on the Friday we call Good Friday. Palm Sunday is capable of great misunderstanding if you don't have the explanation of why Jesus was entering in such a peaceful state that particular city. And for that matter, the Friday that we call Good Friday is also an example of something that you can't understand without an explanation. So isn't it fantastic? Isn't it wonderful of God to have provided all of his people with a complete explanation of what Palm Sunday was and how it led up to Good Friday and how Good Friday led up to Easter Sunday. And God provided this detailed explanation 7 centuries before any of it took place. So that in a way, there was no excuse for anyone there in Jerusalem on Palm Sunday to misunderstand because an explanation had been given in great detail through the prophet Isaiah. And we're continuing our study of the servant song, some of the most explicit explanations in the whole prophecy of Isaiah about the meaning of Christ coming into the world. And here's a quick summary of what we've looked at to date. On the first Sunday of March, we looked at Isaiah 42 and Song 1, the first servant song, in which God spoke of his servant. We called that song the greatest assignment, for God was giving this mysterious person, the servant, a huge and important assignment, nothing less than to establish justice in the earth and to be a light to the nations. The next Sunday, we looked at the second servant song, sung by the servant himself. I called it the greatest complaint, and there the global dimensions of the assignment were explained, how it came about that this Jewish man, this servant, who is Jesus, came to establish justice not just for Israel, but in the earth, and to be a light not just to the people of Israel, but for the nations. Last week, Nate took us to Isaiah 50, and we looked at the third servant song. We called it the greatest humility, and saw there, clearly laid out, clearly explained 700 years before Jesus was born, that the life of Jesus would be a matter of learning obedience through the things which he suffered. And we saw that in learning obedience, the great servant himself, Jesus, redefined greatness in ways that had never been defined before. And now on Palm Sunday, we come to the fourth song, which I'm calling the Great Explanation, because that's what it is. In terms of all the help we get from the first three songs, there's even a greater explanation of what the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus was all about, given in the fourth song, which begins in Isaiah 52. The fourth song explains it all best. And two little details to know about it before we begin looking. One is that it is a duet, and we've seen a duet before where the song is sung both by God himself and God's servant. But here the duet is shared between God and Isaiah, and the prophet who has been recording these songs, and so much more in the prophecy of Isaiah, gets to sing a couple of stanzas of the song. And that's another thing we can note about this song. It's easily seen as a matter of five stanzas or five verses. And the first is sung by God. We'll look at that in just a moment. And then stanza two and stanza three are sung by Isaiah. There's two other stanzas, but the first three will be enough for this morning. So my plan is on Good Friday, 6:30, this Friday evening, here in this room, for a Good Friday communion service, we'll look at the fourth stanza, also sung by Isaiah, and we'll save the fifth stanza. By then, we'll be well on into Isaiah 53 for Easter Sunday, where the song is taken over by and concluded by God himself. And then the explanation will be complete. And then none of us will need to run the risk of not understanding what we're looking at when we think about Jesus because we lack an explanation. So to begin to understand what it is we're considering this morning, what it is we're looking at in our imagination on this Palm Sunday, let's begin with stanza one. This is Isaiah 52, and I'm calling stanza one, God sings of the servant's shocking humiliation. This is Isaiah 52, verses 13 to 15. And this is the stanza that's sung by God himself. And he says, "Behold, my servant shall act wisely." Now, those first three words are the first three words from the first song, "Behold, my servant whom I have chosen." But now he says, "Behold, my servant shall act wisely." And I think that's a pretty clear reference to the third song where Jesus was given the ear of a disciple and he came into the world to learn obedience. And when all was said and done, God is able to sing, "Behold, my servant acts wisely." He goes on, "He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted." And pardon me for sounding like an English professor. My wife isn't here this morning and always warns me off getting professorial, but I'm just going to sound like that for a minute with an explanation. There is a switch in the narrative here, and the singer, God, is singing of the servant, but he sings the next line to the servant. He says, "As many as were astonished at you," and I think what we're to see is that God is so absolutely pleased with his servant, with Jesus, that as he's singing of him, he can't stop himself from turning to him and addressing him. He says, "As many as were astonished at you," and then he regains his composure, so to speak, and gets back to speaking of him, not to him. "As many as were astonished at you," turns, "his appearance was so marred beyond human resemblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind, so shall he sprinkle many nations." And there's certainly a way of understanding the idea of Jesus sprinkling many nations if you think about the Old Testament sacrifices. But your Bible, like my Bible, might show in the margins that the word sprinkle can also be translated as the word startle. And you have to decide on your own, in view of the context, which of the two verbs is more appropriate. He shall sprinkle many nations, or he shall startle many nations. And I'm going to choose startle. So let me back up a bit. "As many as were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of children of mankind, so shall he startle many nations." And he finishes the stanza. "Kings shall shut their mouths because of him, for that which has not been told them they see, and that which they have not heard they understand." Here's the explanation given by God himself about the entrance of Jesus into the world and then into Jerusalem to do all that he rode into Jerusalem on that Palm Sunday to accomplish. And God is serving us notice. People are going to be astonished at how marred his appearance becomes beyond human semblance. He will startle many nations, and kings themselves will be astonished and startled, and they'll shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them, they see, and that which they have not heard, they understand. For they cannot understand without an explanation. We all need an explanation to understand how it came about that this servant that acted so wisely astonished and startled so many people. And that's the first stanza. And before we move on to the second stanza, where Isaiah takes over the song, let me back you up to the opening line, which is verse 13, and show you once again how this stanza began. God says, "Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted." Now that's speaking of the ultimate outcome of this whole startling, shocking, astonishing experience. But I think it's safe to say that anyone who got to Isaiah 52 with any kind of recollection of all that went on in the book of Isaiah before that would have a little chime go off in his head when he hears God the Father singing, "He shall be high and lifted up." Because those words were found in that order at a very important place in the prophecy. Way back in Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah, speaking of his own personal experience, says, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. And the train of his robe filled the temple." This is how Isaiah came to understand the Lord. He had an experience which explained the greatness of God and saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up. The description goes on in Isaiah chapter 6. "Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face. With two he covered his feet. With two he flew." There were these mysterious, majestic, angelic angel beings, supernatural beings. And they had wings, and they were flying with the wings and covering themselves with the wings. And one of them called to another and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And you'll have to read it for yourself if you don't recall the rest of the chapter, but what happens next is very, very clear. Isaiah, seeing the Lord on his throne, high and lifted up, is intensely astonished. He says, "I am lost," or "I am undone," or "I'm doomed at the sight of God and his majesty, the Lord, sitting upon his throne, high and lifted up." And now here, these 50-some chapters later, as God is singing a song about his servant, he uses the same term, high and lifted up, but not to sing about how astonishing it is to see the Lord exalted in the throne room of heaven, but rather how astonishing it is in a very different way to see the Lord who was so marred, so damaged, so hurt by his experience. In the first vision, the chapter 6 vision, Isaiah is absolutely astonished at the highness, the loftiness of the Lord. But now God is singing of people being astonished by the lowliness, by the humiliation of the Lord. And now we get to stanza 2, in which Isaiah takes over the song and sings of the servant's horrible rejection. We've made it into chapter 53. This is verses 1 to 3. And here Isaiah begins with a question. "Who has believed what he's heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him." Here's Isaiah singing of the servant's horrible rejection. And he speaks of the form of the Lord and says he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. And this, I know, is a troublesome prophecy, a prophetic statement of some trouble to all kinds of people. People that you perhaps know, perhaps a person that you are. For it seems to be saying that the servant, Jesus, was not handsome, was not beautiful, no majesty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him. And I've actually been seated in Bible study discussions where it's talked about how impossible it is to believe that Jesus was not good-looking in himself. And I would like to say, please do what you can to understand the obsession which we all have grown up with, which is only getting worse in our culture in these days. For we live among a people absolutely obsessed with physical appearance, especially facial features and body types. But it's a matter of fact that in the Bible, there's really no place where Jesus is described in the way that any biographer would explain or describe him in these days if it were a reporter writing an account of what he saw Jesus do. Because there's never been a society as obsessed as we are with how a face looks and what sort of body a person has. The modern obsession is just very, very modern. And in the histories of Julius Caesar and other historical characters, there's just no biographer thinks to explain what the man looked like and whether he had a rugged jawline and whether his eyes were really, really penetrating. And people just didn't care about facial features and body types. And this passage, this stanza, isn't about that anyway. It's talking about Jesus being someone we would never look at with no beauty that we should desire him in regard to the horrible rejection with which he was rejected. It's clear from the previous stanza, and it's clear from the continuation of this stanza. We're not talking about whether Jesus was a good-looking man. We're talking about how horribly rejected he was by men and by women in his day. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. So here's a good piece of the explanation. Jesus was coming into the earth with an assignment, a great assignment, the greatest assignment. And through his negotiations with the Father, he was given the opportunity to greatly impact the whole world and become a light for the nations, and to establish justice to the nations, but at a horrible cost that would start with him living a humble life and then lead him to being horribly humiliated and rejected, despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, a person accomplished in the experience of sorrow, a person acquainted with grief, well acquainted with what it means to be in a grievous situation. And the effect that that would have on people when it was happening, that rejection would have on people when it was happening, is that he would be one that men would hide their faces from, that kings would be astonished or startled by. So despised was he. So much did we not esteem him. And that's the second stanza. And once again, before moving on to the third stanza, let me back you up to the stanza's opening line once again, which is verse 1. Isaiah starts the second stanza with two questions. Who has believed what he's heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Two questions, which are really one question, asked from two points of view. For this is a question regarding what God has done to save the world, what God has done to make salvation available. And whenever we are thinking about what God does to grant us salvation, to rescue us from our current position, there's always two ways of looking at it. And one way is the point of view by which we emphasize our own responsibilities, the fact that we are held accountable for our motives and our actions and our words and all that we are and do. We are responsible. And so the question comes out in regard to our own responsibility towards God this way. Who has believed what he's heard from us? But whenever we're looking at what God is doing to rescue us, to save us, there's always another perspective, which is a perspective from God's view, in which we see clearly that God is entirely in control of all things and gets the credit for all the good that happens. We're responsible, but God is in control. So the same question asked according to God's sovereign control over all things is what we see as the second question. To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? The question can be asked two ways, you see. Now, for the sake of receiving the full explanation, so that we can more fully understand what it is we're looking at, let me leap you forward those 700 years to Palm Sunday. For that very question turns out to have a lot to do with Palm Sunday, and this we get from the Gospel of John. John, the disciple that Jesus particularly loved, he wrote the fourth book of the New Testament, the Gospel of John, and he tells what happens on Palm Sunday after the parade was over and Jesus was in the city. We looked at this a few weeks ago when a few Greek-speaking people came to the disciples and said, we would like to see Jesus. And following that, we have the account in John chapter 12 of Jesus in a Garden of Gethsemane frame of mind. This is not the day in which he prayed to God, if this cup can be passed from me, nevertheless, not my will. But the very same thing was going on in his mind on Palm Sunday. Here it is recorded in John chapter 12. Here's Jesus, the servant, speaking out loud after that great, glorious, so easy to misunderstand parade. Now is my soul troubled, Jesus says. Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. He goes on, but for this purpose I've come to this hour. So he doesn't say, Father, save me from this hour, but rather he says, Father, glorify your name. And then the most marvelous thing happened. A voice came from heaven. I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. Well, there's a great to-do in the crowd because some thought that they just heard thunder and other people thought they heard an angel speaking, but it was unthinkable to imagine that it was God responding to his prayer, though that, in fact, is what it was. So as we read on in John chapter 12, Jesus answered, this voice has come for your sake, not mine. And then he explains some things about the particular point in history that they were at. And then he says, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. And John explains, he said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. Being lifted up from the earth was understood as an explanation of death by crucifixion. That's how much the world had changed. So then a little later on, same conversation, Jesus says to this crowd of people, while you have the light, he meant while I'm with you, believe in the light, believe in Jesus, that you may become sons of light, that you may be attached in a family relationship to Jesus. Now, John explains, when Jesus had said these things, he departed and hid himself from them. Though he had done so many signs before them, they still did not believe in him. So that the word spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. And here is our question from the second stanza of the fourth song. The word spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. Lord, who has believed what he heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Now John explains, therefore they could not believe. For again Isaiah said, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they see with their eyes and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. And that is a quotation from Isaiah chapter 6, the chapter in which Isaiah saw the Lord. And what Isaiah was assigned in chapter 6, having seen the Lord, is summarized in this that is quoted here to explain Palm Sunday. And then John says, Isaiah said these things because he saw his glory and spoke of him. And John says that, having quoted Isaiah chapter 6, where Isaiah saw the Lord on his throne, high and lifted up, which gives us a chance to note two astonishing things. One, that the year that King Uzziah died, when Isaiah saw the Lord high and lifted up, John says he was seeing Jesus. He was seeing the servant, the Son of God, high and lifted up on the throne. That vision of God, which so undid Isaiah that he said, woe is me, I am undone, or I am lost, or I am doomed, was a vision of the servant sitting on the throne. It was a vision of Jesus. It was Jesus that Isaiah saw and spoke of. That's amazing. But what is amazing as well from this passage is that Jesus, in John chapter 12, is speaking of a whole different way of being lifted up. Not high and lifted up on a throne so that people could see his majesty, but lifted up on a cross in great shame to experience great torture, to be put to death. He was lifted up not on a throne, but on a cross. And all this is alluded to 700 years in advance so that the people of God would have 7 centuries to get their minds around what would happen when God himself, the servant, would appear in human history. So once again, it's a life principle. Sometimes you can't understand what you're seeing or hearing about without an explanation. But the explanation had been given centuries in advance. And so we come to stanza 3, where Isaiah sings the explanation. And this is what he says. Isaiah 53, verse 4, 5, and 6. Here's the explanation of all that's been sung about to this point. Isaiah says, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. We saw him in his astonishing humiliation, and we thought he was a person stricken by God, smitten by God, afflicted by God, but he was bearing our griefs, carrying our sorrows. He was wounded for our transgressions, for every instance in which we crossed a line we shouldn't have crossed, where we trespassed in a way we shouldn't have trespassed, every transgression. He was wounded for them. He was crushed for our iniquities. The word iniquities is basically the word injustices. And every time we have committed an injustice, every time we've done the wrong thing, knowing it was the wrong thing, and going ahead and we went ahead and did it anyway, or said it anyway, or thought it anyway, he was crushed for them, for those iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. He was being chastised by God. He was being rejected by God. He was being punished by God, but it was to bring us peace. And with his wounds, the wounds he received from the Roman scourging, and the wounds he received from the nails in his hands and his feet, the wound he received from the spear that pierced his side, by those wounds we are healed. Isaiah sings, all we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity, the injustices of us all. Now that's the third stanza. And there are 2 more. Isaiah has another one to sing. We'll look at it Good Friday. And God finishes the song. And we'll look at that on Easter Sunday. But we have heard enough this morning for a question to be asked. And it's a question based on the principle that sometimes you can't understand what you're looking at or hearing about without an explanation, but we have just seen from God himself and from Isaiah an ancient explanation which makes clear enough what it is we're seeing when we're thinking about Jesus entering Jerusalem and going through all the historical events of what we call Easter week. So we are ready for a question. And it's the question that Isaiah has already asked. The question is, who has believed what he has heard from us, from God and Isaiah? And it's a question I bring to your attention this morning. Who's believed it? Who here has believed it? Do you believe it? Do you believe what you've heard from God and from Isaiah? And will you live believing it? That is the question. Are you entrusting yourself through faith to this great servant of the Lord who has suffered 2,000 years ago now such humiliation in order to bear our griefs, in order to carry our sorrows, in order to bear your griefs, in order to carry your sorrows? Are you entrusting yourself to this great servant of the Lord who suffered such humiliation, such pain, wounded for our transgressions, wounded for your transgressions? He was crushed for our iniquities. Do you believe that? Do you believe he was crushed under the weight of the wrath of God for your iniquities? Do you believe that upon him was the chastisement that brought you peace? That what he was doing on the cross had to do with you being at peace with God? Do you believe that? Do you believe that by his wounds, by his stripes, you can be healed? Do you believe that the Lord laid on him your iniquity and the iniquity of us all? There's two ways to ask the question, and I've been asking it in regard to your accountability, to your responsibility before God, to believe these things that the Bible says, that Isaiah says, that God says are true. But the other way to ask it is from the other point of view. To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? And I bring up the second question to say this, that if in all honesty, with integrity, you cannot say, I believe it. Perhaps you want to, but you know you'd be lying if you said, I believe it. Maybe there's just too many things holding you back, too many personal hang-ups or limitations that prevent you from saying, yes, I believe in Jesus. Well, then are you willing to have the arm of the Lord, the power of the Lord, reveal this to you? If that's your case, then this is my challenge, that this week, this really important week in the Christian calendar, as we approach Good Friday with Easter Sunday just beyond it, will you pray and ask God with that integrity, with that sincerity, to reveal to you what has been revealed through the prophet and by God himself? We ask God this week to help you believe, to strengthen you in your spiritual convictions, your religious ideals, so that you can believe in Jesus and believe that what Jesus did on the cross was for your griefs and your sorrows and your transgressions and your iniquities. An idea would be to make a plan this week to look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I mean, just the last two or three chapters. That's the account of Jesus going through this shocking humiliation. And I would hope that God in his grace and mercy would be pleased to answer a prayer prayed sincerely. As you read the last couple of chapters of Matthew and Mark and Luke and John, maybe one a night as you're going to bed or in the morning as you're starting your day, read the couple of chapters, read about the death of Christ, and ask the Lord to reveal to you what he has revealed so miraculously to so many people, including many people who are here. Sometimes you can't understand what you're looking at without an explanation. But we have the explanation. It's been given to us. It's now 2,700 years old here in the prophet Isaiah. And so we have the explanation. Maybe we do understand enough of what we're looking at to entrust ourselves wholeheartedly to Christ. Maybe you're ready to do that just now. As I pray, the team is going to come forward and lead us in a few songs that give us the opportunity at the beginning of this Easter week to contemplate the wonder of the thing. And then, as God enables you, to turn with faith, turn with commitment to the one who paid such a price. Let's pray. Lord, we are so indebted to you for your word and what you have revealed through the prophet Isaiah and the other prophets, and the writers of the New Testament as well. With what has been explained, Lord, help us then to put aside all excuses and to understand with our whole heart what we are looking at today. And reveal yourself further to us wherever there is more help needed, that we might be the people who gladly commit ourselves to you, believing with our whole heart that Jesus the servant has been high and lifted up and now is exalted at your right hand. Help us, Lord, that we might be your faithful followers. Amen.